Welcome to The Starfield, a podcast about space, astronomers, and how exactly one enters this field of study. I'm your host, Hannah Marker, an undergraduate at the University of Arizona. When you're a scientist in training, it's easy to focus on those science classes and nothing else. When I chose classes early in my undergrad coursework to fulfill those general education courses, I was a little bummed I couldn't take all astronomy or astronomy-adjacent classes. So I chose more by topic requirement, how interesting I thought the class sounded, than any burning desire to be well-rounded. Lucky for me, the teachers in these classes were brilliant, and they understood something that as scientists, we should know. Good communication transcends the boundaries of the field. Getting an idea across is something we should all be able to do, and ultimately, these non-science classes I hadn't really wanted to take taught me how to do that. We talk today about the importance of good communication skills in astronomy and in the science community as a whole. Through our three segments, we'll learn about how being able to clearly express ideas to other people in the field and to people in other disciplines is part of doing good science. As for the details, stay with us. We want to start today by looking at another object in Dr. Chris Impey's office. Dr. Impey is Distinguished Professor of Astronomy and Associate Dean of the College of Science, and his office is full of artifacts from his trips around the world. He's a masterful communicator as well, both verbally and in writing. He lectures not just for students, but for NASA engineers and Tibetan Buddhists in India. The item we're looking at in his office today is another testament to his ability to communicate well. It's a photograph on a wall of other photographs. And really, it doesn't stand out too much. It's not huge, maybe 10 inches wide and 8 inches tall. And in it are three men. One looks like some sort of administrator. The second is Dr. Impey, a little bit younger. His hair is longer, and it's actually in a ponytail that he doesn't have anymore. And then there's a third man, dressed in distinctive garb that makes him instantly recognizable, even if you don't know his face.
There's a picture of me shaking hands with John Paul II, the deceased pope. These three popes going three popes back now.
That's Dr. Impey talking about the photograph, and yes, you heard that right. The third man in the photograph is none other than Pope John Paul II, head of the Catholic Church from 1978 to 2005. Now, in case you don't know a lot about this, the way I didn't, you don't just get to meet the pope. Which begs the question, how did Dr. Impey?
Lucky enough, in 1995, I taught at the Vatican Observatory Summer School. That's a surprise to a lot of people that the Vatican itself has astronomers working for it, and they run summer schools, and they do astronomy. They don't just do Catholic stuff. And as a culmination of the summer school, we got an audience with the Pope, and we all got to shake hands with the Pope, and, you know, it was a pretty special, I'm not of that religion or of any religion, but it was a pretty special moment.
The Vatican Observatory Summer School is held in the Papal Palace outside Rome. Dr. Impey tells me the palace and the grounds have been there for about 500 years, and now every 2 years, about 20 students are selected to study and work on a topic in astronomy. The last one was held last summer. I asked Dr. Impey, how do you get to teach at the Vatican Observatory? Turns out, it's communication and networking.
Nearly 2-meter telescope on Mount Graham, which they still run. So we've had this very strong connection between the University of Arizona and the Vatican Observatory.
As astronomers, the divide society places between religion and science is broad, due to our study of topics like the origin of the universe, where there can be vast ideological differences. It turns out, though, a little communication goes a long way, and the Vatican Observatory is one of those places where science and religion exist in harmony, and in fact have for quite some time.
The Vatican Observatory has existed for a couple hundred years. The long history, of course, is that the Vatican cared about the calendar, and so they kept the calendar as a way of regulating civic life, and so they had astronomers to keep time and to keep the calendar. And now we're back almost to the time of Galileo. And then in the sort of middle of the 19th century, some of the astronomers who were keeping time, because you need to be an astronomer to do that well, they were interested in research and said, well, can't we study stars and galaxies? Can't we do research? And so they just gradually started doing research. And so they'd been doing 100 years of research with small telescopes in Rome, where it's a terrible place to do astronomy. And in the 1920s, they got to build some slightly bigger telescopes outside Rome at Castel Gandolfo, and that was good. And then in the 70s, it's still near Rome, so they said, can't we build some bigger telescopes? And they got that Pope, John Paul II, to agree to let them build a telescope in Arizona, in southern Arizona.
Pope John Paul II is also responsible for the official pardoning of Galileo Galilei, the Italian astronomer who championed the sun-centric model of the solar system so strongly that it was called heresy by the Roman Inquisition, and who is at odds with the Catholic Church for most of the latter half of his life. Pope John Paul II also organized two interdisciplinary conferences at the Vatican Observatory in an effort to, quote, contribute to the dialogue between the two cultures of science and religion. You can't communicate much more clearly than that. Anyway, back on that item in Dr. Impey's office. There's another photo right next to that first one.
And it's also sitting alongside me with another Pope, Benedict, and I have to spread the love, so in my other office in Gould Simpson, I have me with the current Pope Francis, who I met 2 years ago. So I'm up to three popes, you know.
That's right. Not one pope, but three. Effective communication isn't just crossing barriers between different disciplines, though. It's also important within our own field. Writing proposals, getting grant money, sharing data. Effective communication is what we need to accomplish projects. No one knows that better than the people who are in charge of those projects.
So my name is Beth Willman, and I'm an astronomer. Right now, my job is to be the deputy director for the National Center for Optical Infrared Astronomy.
To get to Dr. Beth Willman's office, I left the Stewart Observatory and got buzzed into the National Optical Astronomy Observatory headquarters, right across the street. I told the receptionist I was there for an interview and waited while she called Dr. Willman to let her know I had arrived. We walked down a series of hallways that seemed impossibly long for the size of the building from the outside, and finally got to Dr. Willman's office, where a whiteboard was covered in project notes, and Dr. Willman was waiting for me. It turns out, as impressive as that initial introduction she gave me was, it only gets more impressive from there.
As an astronomer, I wear two hats. One hat is in my research field, which is to use detailed observations of the very nearby universe to pursue the answers to large cosmological questions. The other hat that I wear is in my managerial and leadership role, and that's to pursue the funding, to build the infrastructure, and to lead and develop the teams necessary to pull off the current and next generation of major U.S.-funded federal astronomical facilities.
She's doing less research now that she's come to Tucson, although she still supports the research of others in her group. Now, what she does almost all the time is communicate.
A typical day for me involves me having many meetings. Some days I have back-to-back meetings from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Other days they're more sporadic. And in my meetings, I get to interact with everybody from federal funding agency staff members to directors of observatories to the foundational staff that enable all of this to happen. Right now today, my favorite thing about my job is that I get to interact with people who enable the scientific enterprise in so many different ways. I don't just get to interact with scientists, I get to interact with safety professionals and IT professionals and administrative professionals and observatory directors and technicians and engineers to really get a holistic understanding of what it takes to build the largest scientific experiments that humans can build and what it takes to then enable the broadest range of people to turn those experiments into scientific results.
That's a huge range of people, directors, scientists, general staff. Dr. Willman's job is just as much about listening to them as it is anything else, so that she can, quote, find out what people need to get their jobs done to help us all work towards our collective mission of enabling discovery at the cutting edge of the universe. As you can tell, Dr. Willman is an excellent communicator. She chooses her words carefully, and when I made a comment about how it can be difficult to navigate the transition from one area of science to another, the way she did from physics to astronomy, she first clarified the definition of the word difficult before discussing the red tape of academia.
That depends on how we mean the word difficult. So if we take a look at the total number of people on Earth, or even the total number of scientists, and compare that to the total number of astronomers, the total number of astronomers is very small. So anytime you pursue an endeavor where there aren't very many individuals that have that opportunity, you know, there's some difficulty, small number statistics there.
One of Dr. Willman's goals is to impact those small number statistics. Astronomy as a field is changing, and the way we communicate and who we communicate with are essential drivers of that change.
We're in an era where the experiments that are being built, both computational experiments and observational experiments, are acquiring ever increasingly large data sets. And the culture in our field, is moving in a direction where people are coalescing around the idea that these enormous data sets, one, should be broadly shared with as many people as possible, and two, should be shared in a way that enables as broad a community as possible to participate in the process of scientific discovery with these open data sets.
Part of what drives Dr. Willman's work is broadening, quote, the diversity of participation in STEM fields. She wants to get the cutting-edge data in as many hands as possible.
I think it's incredibly important to increase the diversity of participation in STEM fields for a lot of different reasons. A key one is, frankly, so that we can continue as humankind to make the most exciting and amazing discoveries in the universe. And the fact that we're moving towards an era where people who aren't necessarily at the most wealthy and privileged institutions are going to have their hands on the most awesome and cool data is something that is really important to me.
This generation of scientists and the next ones are going to be the ones making those new discoveries in our universe. Yes, they will need to be prepared for the math and the science, but they'll also have to work with a larger field of scientists to imagine and modify and collaborate and send their ideas to a much bigger group of astronomers than we have today. I think you can guess by now what skill that's going to require.
Really, the most successful scientists are strong communicators. They're creative. They're collaborators. And so to really generate and spread good scientific discoveries requires a great diversity of skills and interests. So it's a more human endeavor than folks might think on the surface.
However, as essential as all those skills are, Dr. Willman also stresses the importance of doing what you're passionate about.
What is your passion? What drives the fire in your belly? What makes you feel excited in your gut and your heart? And then, you know, what makes you feel interested and engaged in your mind?
There you have it. Just a few tips to being an astronomer. Do what you love and be ready to tell the world. Finally, I want to talk about the importance of knowing what you want to communicate. To do that, I want to use a prime example of a communication tool, the Voyager Golden Record. The Voyager spacecrafts were launched in August 1977. Both of the spacecraft toured our solar system, giving us early data about the planets that move around our sun. Then, the spacecraft continued outward. Neither of them have left the solar system yet. They're both kind of at the edge of the Oort cloud, where comets come from. But they're headed out and away from Earth. Because they are going away from us and into the dark arms of interstellar space, scientists have prepared the Voyager spacecrafts for many scientific possibilities, including contact with alien life. So, just in case Voyager meets aliens, the spacecraft are both carrying a phonographic record. The record is small, a 12-inch gold-plated copper disc, and it's packaged inside an aluminum sleeve along with a needle and a cartridge and symbolic directions on how to play it. Then comes the question. If you're going to put something on a spacecraft and you only get one record to communicate with an alien life form, what do you tell them?
Namaste. Telugu matlade janamulu nunchi maa subhakankshalu.
Milí přátelé, přejeme vám vše nejlepší.
Namaste. Kannadi gara paravagi subhashayagalu.
Sab logo ne maro ram ram ponche, hame athe raji khushi ha, tuma uthe raji khushi reh jao.
Hello from the children of planet Earth.
The team that decided what would go on the record was headed by Carl Sagan of Cosmos fame. They chose 116 images in analog form, a variety of natural sounds, a 90-minute selection of music from around the world, brainwaves of a person thinking about Earth's history, and spoken greetings in 55 languages, including a greeting in English from the then Secretary General of the UN, Kurt Waldheim. The images were chosen to detail life on Earth and give information about where the record is coming from. What is our planet like? Where is our solar system? Who are we sending this message? They include images showing the location of the solar system in the Milky Way, mathematical and physical definitions, a spectrum of the sun, DNA structure, human anatomy, reproductive, skeletal, and musculature systems, different images of animals and people eating, reading, dancing, flying, studying, working. Doing, in other words, some of the things that make us human. The team that selected these images hoped that they, along with the other material on the record, would communicate to alien life who we were, and why we reach out into space to try to learn if we are alone or not. As Carl Sagan noted, the spacecraft will be encountered and the record played only if there are advanced spacefaring civilizations in interstellar space. But the launching of this bottle into the cosmic ocean says something very hopeful about life on this planet. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Starfield. This episode is produced and hosted by me, Hannah Marker, in partnership with Active Galactic Videos, Teach Astronomy, and the University of Arizona. For more information about Active Galactic Videos or this week's space news, check out the links in the podcast description. Many thanks to Dr. Beth Willman for taking time to interview with us this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or whatever streaming service you use. Until next time, this has been The Starfield.